From the studios of Wavefront Audio Visual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 121 of Little Brother for the 4th of March, 2023. March 4th and conquer, my friends. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Volkswagen, like many automakers, has a networked GPS-enabled package of features that probably most of us most of the time don't actually need. As such, allowing a subscription to lapse is not particularly out of the ordinary. A couple of weeks ago in Illinois, however, the owner of such a vehicle with a lapsed subscription had her car stolen while her 2-year-old child was in the back seat. Detectives from the Lake County Sheriff's Office contacted Volkswagen to see if they would be able to track the car, to which Volkswagen's response was, "That'll be $150, please." A half hour elapsed while the detective scrambled to find a credit card that could be used for the purpose, during which time the car was located by other means. Volkswagen have said that this is not normal operating procedure and that this should not have happened. In the state of Indiana, a law is making its way through the Senate that would create a new crime: remote criminal tracking. The crime would be a misdemeanor and carry a potential penalty of a $5,000 fine and a year in jail. The law would ban the use of GPS or other tracking technologies used to stalk a person. It contains exceptions for law enforcement, parental tracking of minor children, devices placed on personal property, automakers tracking vehicles for commercial purposes, and tracking of formerly incarcerated people who are being tracked as a condition of their release. An amendment to grant an exception for private investigators was not successful. In a stunning display of administrative masturbation, a Russian court has issued a fine of 2 million rubles, or about $26,000 as of this writing, against the Wikimedia Foundation. The fine was levied for Wikimedia's refusal to delete information from their flagship Wikipedia that the Russian government deems to be misinformation. This is the third time that Russia has issued such fines against the foundation since the invasion of Ukraine in February of last year. As it stands, it seems as though the foundation would be unable to pay the fine even if they wanted to, due to financial sanctions that have been placed on Russia, and it similarly appears that the Russian Federation has absolutely no mechanism by which they could compel payment. As my regular listeners well know, one of my biggest pet peeves is poor cybersecurity. It's why I tell you all to patch your systems. Cybersecurity is taken so casually that not a week goes by that I don't have at least one story to tell you about who got pwned this week. It seems I'm not alone in observing this. On Thursday, the Biden administration published a document called the National Cybersecurity Strategy, And in it, the administration is seeking to hold organizations responsible for their cybersecurity gaffes. The document lays out a 5-point plan to improve our nation's cybersecurity, especially in the face of increasing global tensions and in the wake of events such as the Colonial Pipeline shutdown from a few years ago. On Monday, the Biden administration set a deadline of 30 days, by which time TikTok will no longer be permitted on federal devices. This is in response to a congressional vote a couple of months ago that gave the president 60 days to issue policy directives banning TikTok. Recent airborne events have led to more detailed scrutiny of all things involving China in foreign policy. ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, has denied using the app to spy on Americans and claims that concerns over its usage are unfounded. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Week. Didn't I just talk about this in the headlines? We're looking at two this week. First up, Dish Network. To quote Shakespeare, "Are you yet living?" Well, apparently they are, because they've been investigating what they are describing as a cybersecurity incident, which has resulted in some data being exfiltrated and some internal systems being shut down for several days. The result for customers has been an inability to activate new equipment or make other account changes, either for Dish Network customers or customers of Dish's sister brands, Boost Infinite and Boost Mobile. However, the big one this week is the U.S. Marshals Service. The U.S. Marshals Service is the oldest law enforcement agency in the U.S., having been established during the Washington administration. In its present form, it's managed by the Department of Justice and is primarily concerned with the protection of judges and other judicial branch personnel. A system within the Marshals Service suffered a ransomware attack. Said system contains law enforcement-sensitive information, and an investigation is ongoing to determine both the origin of the attack and the extent of the damage. BetterHelp advertises as a provider of online therapy, counseling, and mental health services. You probably already knew that. I'm sure you've heard or seen their ads. They're fucking everywhere. On the face of it, online mental health counseling seems like a really worthwhile idea. It seems especially so in the wake of a pandemic. It may actually still be one, but this is probably not the place to go get it. You see, privacy is core to mental health. Mental health care is health care. It should come with the same expectations of privacy as when you talk to your physician. When you talk to a counselor, a therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, etc., you are talking to a health care professional. Yes, I'm repeating myself a bit here, but I want to cement this idea that the person you talk to get whatever mental health care you seek, that person is bound by professional ethics to keep your secrets as a healthcare professional. And to be honest, if we've come to trust our mental health professional, if we've built the right rapport in the service of getting the advice or the help that you need to get past whatever it is that's holding you back, whatever you are working through, that person is bound to be in possession of some of your deepest, darkest secrets, things that cause you fear or shame. I suppose that to some degree, this may be true of a physician as well, but when mental health is in question, I think it goes double, if not more. So, what's the problem? Simple. The Federal Trade Commission just had to state the obvious to BetterHelp. Allow me to share with you a couple of juicy paragraphs from an order that the FTC is issuing to BetterHelp. Quote, recognizing the sensitivity of this health information, respondent has repeatedly promised to keep it private and to use it only for non-advertising purposes, such as to facilitate consumers' therapy. From 2013 to December 2020, however, respondent continually broke these privacy promises, monetizing consumers' health information to target them and others with advertisements for the service. For example, from 2018 to 2020, respondent used these consumers' email addresses and the fact that they had previously been in therapy to instruct Facebook to identify similar consumers and target them with advertisements for the service, bringing in tens of thousands of new paying users and millions of dollars in revenue as a result. End quote. Fucking mic drop. The order further goes on to state that BetterHelp also shared intimate, identifiable mental health care information with other social media platforms as well, not just Facebook, but also Pinterest, Snapchat, and Criteo, often permitting these companies to use the information for their own research and product development as well. Fucking excuse me? When you sign up, aren't you, paying for this service? What business do they have monetizing you? And even then, what business do they have monetizing your very personal data that may contain your deepest, darkest secrets? Speaking of signing up, like with many services, when you sign up, you are presented with a wall of text that you have to agree to. Somewhere along the line, I want to talk about these because I think they're a crime in and of themselves. But somewhere, buried deep in the darkest folds of the thickest legalese, there's a clause that authorizes them to share your personal information in a limited, encrypted manner to optimize the effectiveness of their advertising campaigns. I don't think this qualifies. Apparently the FTC doesn't either. It's not ethical, of course, for a mental health professional to diagnose a patient that they have not seen, but since I am not a mental health professional, I'm going to go ahead and speculate that when you find the person who greenlit this idea, you'll find a sociopath. There is no way in this universe that this can even begin to be acceptable. So I'm here again this month at the Albany 2600 meeting. We come together on the first Friday of every month at 6 o'clock at the Starbucks in Stuyvesant Plaza. And I have a few questions that I'm going to throw to the crowd tonight, and we'll see what we get. On February 28th, the Russian media were hacked to send out an emergency alert to advise people to take shelter. If you could do that to the Russian media, would you do that, and what would you do?
I don't know. I would think very carefully about what to say because I'd only have one chance, I think.
I would issue an announcement to the Russian public that we regret to inform you of the demise of Comrade Stalin. He's a leader, a hero who will never be forgotten. And we must also alert you to the presence of an imposter who is running around issuing crazy orders. He is to be captured alive if possible, but immediately consider him extremely dangerous and alert the authorities.
Announce that Putin passed away.
Okay, so they could have a Swan Lake moment, as it were.
I have not seen Swan Lake.
Russian media, anytime that there's a massive change at the top of the government, the Russian media will pretty much go quiet, except for they will show Swan Lake on repeat. And it's kind of a way to try to keep the people calm and entertained so they don't know what's going on.
I'm kind of low-tech. I'd want to inspire them to think. I would tell them that down at the library there was money accidentally put in the books.
Let's suppose you could do the same thing to the American media. What would you do?
I haven't a clue. I think the people who can be reached are more or less aware of what they need to know, and the rest appear to be impervious to any message whatsoever. I hope I'm wrong about that.
Deepfake of the network CEO smack-talking a competing network.
Those were, in no particular order, the voices of Pete Houston, Sky Raider, and The Axe That Slayed Me. As I alluded to in the last segment, there was an amusing pwn on the Russian broadcast media this past week. In the pwn, residents in some regions were advised to take cover because of an incoming missile attack. The missiles never materialized. Back in episode 81, I discussed the exceptional ease with which such an attack could be carried out here in the U.S. I think this is worth a recap. During what has come to be known as the Cold War era, roughly the 1950s through the 1980s, a few systems were established in order to spread an emergency message across the country quickly and efficiently. The first such system was called CONELRAD. That's a portmanteau of the words Control of Electronic Radiation, basically meaning that this was a protocol for shutting down broadcast television and radio stations so that their signals couldn't be used for navigation by hostile aircraft. Obviously, the intent here was for this system to cover the situation of the U.S. being under attack without much intent towards other sorts of emergencies. But if the broadcasters are shut down, how do you get vital information to the people? The answer comes in the form of radio stations operated by the government on two specific frequencies, 640 AM and 1240 AM. FM, while it had been invented and deployed, was something of a luxury item at the time, so it wasn't even necessary to say AM. During normal conditions, these would broadcast news, and during an attack, they would broadcast vital information. But the specific transmitters that were running at any given time, those would be randomized. Some might be running at one point in time, then shut down later, or vice versa. Again, the idea was to make sure that they couldn't be used as beacons for navigation. Eventually, it was decided that this sort of control of the airwaves wasn't really necessary. A newer system was developed. It was called the Emergency Broadcast System, or EBS. The EBS concept involved building a daisy-chained network of radio stations out of regular broadcasters. A specific signal was chosen, a pair of tones, one each at 853 Hz and 960 Hz, and this was chosen because it was extremely unlikely to happen accidentally, and it made an absolutely jarring combination. Here, have a listen. So what would happen is that the smaller radio stations and TV stations would monitor the broadcasts of the larger ones. And when that tone was broadcast, the smaller radio station would switch from regular programming to rebroadcasting the larger station. Detecting the signal was automated, but it was up to the operator at the station to know to switch over. Additionally to that, a list of passwords was distributed to radio stations that could be used to initiate an alert. If the authorities called the station to initiate an alert, they would know the password that had been assigned to that station for that date. Next, that brings us to the current version, which rolled out in the late 1990s. The new system is called the Emergency Alert System. Just like with the emergency broadcast system, it uses a signal that is unlikely to happen accidentally. Here, for instance, is a test from my local PBS television station interrupting a newscast.
Said, most people... No one knows officially.
The advancement here, versus the emergency broadcast system, is that the digital data contained in that message provides some information about what area the message applies to, and what the nature of the emergency is. You'll notice that there are three long bursts, then three short ones. The short ones indicate an end of the emergency. The long ones have all of the routing and identification info. Between the two, if the alert is relevant, the downstream station will completely automatically cut over to the audio from the upstream station, allowing voice messages to be passed along. Unlike EBS, EAS is also used by the National Weather Service in its weather radio broadcasts, where it's called Specific Area Message Encoding, or SAME. You can buy a SAME-enabled weather radio, and it can sit and wait for a signal that's relevant to you, which really is kind of cool. So, why am I describing all of this? Well, the weakness is that daisy chaining of radio and TV stations. It seems to me as though if you were able to create a reasonable facsimile of a proper EAS alert using information publicly available describing the protocol, in conjunction with some software to create the actual digital signal, get that on the air somehow, in the vicinity of where a station is monitoring, boom, you own the airwaves. I am amazed that there are no stories out there of this happening already. As usual, we'll end this week's show with the fail of the week. In the state of Texas, we have what appears to be a profound failure of security on the part of the Department of Public Safety. This is the department in the state of Texas that has the duty of issuing driver's licenses and state ID cards. In other states, it might be called the Department of Motor Vehicles. Anyway, it appears as though an organized crime group were able to persuade the Texas DPS to send the driver's licenses of at least 3,000 Texas residents to them. I mean, send it to the scammers, not to the residents. That right there is an identity thief's wet dream. Official, real, state-generated ID cards delivered right to their door. The group was then selling the licenses to people who are in the country illegally. The state says that they will give priority status to any fraudulent use of the affected individual's identities. What, no useless free credit monitoring for a year? I'm shocked. In other news, Twitter was offline around the world for about an hour on Wednesday. It's unlikely that most folks in the U.S. would have noticed, as this happened at around 5:20 a.m. Eastern Time, but it was noticed in other parts of the world. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the crowd at Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Art, Azriel, sudo-rm-rf/double-no-preserve-root, Julie Bernstein, Fungaboo, and KnightRider 007 for story leads, and to Snackness for consulting on one story. Additional thanks to Pete Houston, The Axe That Slayed Me, and Sky Raider for appearing on the show. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Pwnt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Volkswagen, like many automakers, has a networked GPS-enabled... Let's start it again. To see if they would be able to take to track the car. Shit. However, the big one this week... Start again. So I have Sky Raider here, and the question is... Shit.
Well, I don't have an answer to that. It's everywhere, and we do the best we can about it.